Greetings, sensationalists from across the fruity plains.
You're listening to The Andy Finn Show.
The smooth talk of the town.
Cool.
We are back on The Andy Finn Show. And let's talk a little bit more about Al Gore and global warming. So Al Gore won the Nobel Peace Prize, and the reaction from the other side was really astounding. Now, keep in mind, the far right argues that global warming is fake. It's a hoax. There's nothing to it. And so if you honestly believe that, and I do think they honestly believe it, you would see the Nobel Committee giving Gore the prize. Well, the first thing they say is, well, it's not about peace. You know, what's global warming got to do with peace? Actually, the rules for the prize refer to the betterment of the planet, I think. But it's mostly talking about peace. But the Nobel Committee often supplies the prize to encourage the world to focus on something. For example, they might give it to a dissident leader in some country to draw attention to the fact that that country is repressing its people. In any case, it's not. In some ways, it's not surprising that the far right has sour grapes about this. But it's really, I mean, the level of ignorance is really astounding in this regard, that we've got thousands of scientists on one side that say, we believe this is a problem. And scientists are usually pretty reasonable people. They don't, you know, go for radical solutions and say, you must take action, you must take action. But in fact, it's gotten to the point where they have come out and said, you must take action in several reports in the last few years, because they are alarmed that the world is not taking this seriously enough, and that the United States, and particularly the Bush administration, is not taking it seriously enough. Because it gets to a point where these long-term trends, if they are reversible, and scientists believe they are, you get to a certain point, it's very, very difficult to reverse them. And the longer you wait, the more trouble we're in, is the argument. Now, here's Bill Kristol on Fox News Sunday yesterday, talking about Al Gore's award.
Nobel laureate Al Gore. Bill, how do you like the sound of that?
It's deeply moving. You know, I just, Friday, I felt a warm glow thinking that this man got the Nobel Peace Prize for bloviating about global warming. I mean, it's a prize given by bloviators to a bloviator. For nothing. What did he was vice president of the United States for 8 years. I missed the Clinton administration's bold initiatives on global warming and carbon caps. Did they enforce the Kyoto Treaty? I don't think so. You know, so he gets the Nobel Peace Prize for talking when brave people in Burma and in Iraq and journalists in Russia are being killed by dictators, and the Nobel Committee, of course, has no interest in any of them.
Well, a couple of things to note about Bill Kristol's comments. The first is, when he says the Nobel Committee has no interest in any of them, for example, in Burma, as he mentioned, it was less than 5 years ago that they gave the award to Aung San Suu Kyi, the dissident who's been under house arrest in Burma for several years. So he either doesn't know that or he conveniently forgets that. And to argue that, what did Al Gore do about this? He was vice president for 8 years. Forgive me for bringing this up, but wasn't it John Adams who said that the vice presidency was the most useless office that the mind of man had ever devised, or something like that? Because the vice president actually has no power. Now, what Bill Kristol's unfamiliar with in this administration is a president that is in control of his administration. You know, Bill Clinton, George Bush Sr., Ronald Reagan would never have allowed their vice president to dominate their administration the way Bush has allowed Cheney to dominate in his administration. There was a power vacuum, a leadership vacuum, and so Cheney moved in and sucked up the oxygen. But, I mean, you would even go back to Jimmy Carter. He didn't allow his vice president. Everyone likes to say that he was a weak president, but he didn't allow his vice president to run things. Cheney has been running a lot of things. And so maybe that's what Bill Kristol's thinking about here. In any case, it's a serious case of sour grapes, but it continues. Here's Charles Krauthammer on the same show, Fox News Sunday, yesterday morning, when it was his turn to comment.
Look, let's remember what the prize is about. Al Gore now joins the ranks of Yasser Arafat, the father of modern terrorism, Lee Duck Tho, who signed a treaty on behalf of a government that 2 years later invaded and extinguished the country it signed that treaty with.
Let me stop there for a moment. So he's pointing out that Yasser Arafat got the prize. That's true, but he shared it with Menachem Begin, okay? And the two of them got it because the Nobel Committee wanted to help along the peace process in the Middle East. Now, you can say that's unrealistic. There'll never be peace. Maybe that's Charles Krauthammer's position. But in fact, the principle of giving it to the two of them is to encourage peace. As I mentioned before, the Nobel Committee sometimes gets out front on these issues, hoping to affect events. And of course, Krauthammer, to make his point, is not going to mention the Israeli prime minister that got it. I don't know if he considers him worthy or not. He's only going to mention Arafat. The same with Lee Duck Tho. He doesn't mention that Lee Duck Tho, the negotiator for Ho Chi Minh during the Vietnam War, shared the prize with our own Henry Kissinger. That's right, Henry Kissinger, the man that a lot of liberals think has a lot of blood on his hands from the Vietnam War, because we could have gotten the same deal years earlier than Nixon did, but Nixon kept saying we'd have peace with honor and never peace with surrender. Is that starting to sound familiar? Kissinger and Nixon kept the war going, bombed them into submission, at least bombed the North Vietnamese to the peace table in Paris, where they finally agreed and said, okay, we'll sign whatever deal you want, just leave. Then when we left, the inevitable happened. South Vietnam fell. And so Krauthammer, though, is only going to mention that Lee Duck Tho got the prize, not that Henry Kissinger shared it with him. And I wonder if he thinks Henry Kissinger is a worthy recipient of the prize. He doesn't say. Let's let him continue.
With, and the most disgraceful ex-president of the United States, Jimmy Carter, who, forget about Iraq, I'll remind you, in the Gulf War, actively lobbied other countries to oppose his country in helping it in going to war. So, look, this is a treaty that has nothing to do...
Well, it's not a treaty. He forgot that part. But, so Jimmy Carter is the most disgraceful ex-president. That's interesting, since if we go back just through the last four Republican presidents, we don't have to go back more than 30 years. The last four Republican presidents were Nixon, Reagan, Bush 1, and this Bush. And he's saying Jimmy Carter was a more disgraceful president than Richard Nixon. There's a very tiny minority in the country that would agree with him on that. And the verdict is still out, of course, on George W. Bush. But it's not looking like it's a real successful administration based on what we got so far from him. So, but again, these are far-right Republicans who have a certain point of view on this whole thing. You know, I don't even feel like playing the... Well, we might as well. This is actually pretty funny. This is Fox and Friends. I think it was Saturday morning on Fox and Friends. Now, this is lightweight news anchor kinds of things, but they all have opinions, of course. And they bring on a conservative reporter from the Daily News to make the case that the Nobel Committee should have given the prize to General Petraeus, right? As though the Nobel Committee would give it to a military person. I don't believe they ever have. Like, I don't think Eisenhower got it for winning World War II. You know, you just don't give the Nobel Prize out to somebody that's very good at making war.
We've been talking about it, Al Gore winning the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize, but according to our next guest, someone else who's already received an army of praise, well, is far more worthy of the honor.
We're joined now by New York Sun columnist Seth Cattell, who's in Boston. Seth, good morning. Who should have gotten it?
Well, somebody who is actually helping to preserve order and create safety for innocent people, General Petraeus in Iraq.
General David Petraeus, why? What has he been able to do to accomplish the Nobel Peace Prize and be worthy of it?
Well, you've seen, for example, that General Petraeus has helped oversee the surge, which has encouraged the embattled Sunni people in the Anbar province to come and want to work with the American forces against terrorists, people who are taking innocent lives. The thing is, there's precedent here. In the past, the award's been given to UN peacekeepers. In the 1950s, it was given to George Marshall for the Marshall Plan. General Petraeus is doing the same thing today in Iraq, and unlike the UN peacekeepers of the past, he's actually achieving it.
Yeah, but they wouldn't have done that. I mean, look at the members of the Nobel Peace Prize membership. One of them, five people vote for this. One of them is a member of the Socialist Left Party of Norway. And not only were they are against the Iraq War. Okay, they're against the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, going after the Taliban at first. They're not going to give this to Petraeus.
Well, I mean, then they're really not doing, they're not giving it to somebody who is actually doing something to create peace.
What I love about that logic, and this goes on for another 2 minutes, I don't have the stomach to play it. What I love about that logic, it's very similar to a quote from George W. Bush, and it's very much a 1984-ish quote. If you remember 1984, black was white, right was wrong, that kind of thing. There's this great quote from Bush in which he says, when we're talking about war, we're really talking about peace. No, it doesn't work that way. I know you want to say we're building a lasting peace by going to war, but no committee that's giving out a peace prize is going to give it to someone who's good at making war. And why somebody can't see that, I just don't understand. You can say the Nobel Prize Committee is naive. You can say whatever you want. You can say they don't know how the world works, how power is exercised. You can say what you want. But it doesn't make sense to claim that they should be giving it out to someone who's very good at making war. And I assume we'd have to agree that Petraeus is a good general, and that's what a good general does. Anyway, that is just a little bit from the right. But let me wrap this up by pointing out something else that I've talked to you about before. And that is that how political this whole issue is of global warming. The far right can't see this. But if you are someone that is skeptical about global warming, I want to give you two things to think about. Okay, by skeptical, it's okay to be skeptical, but the evidence, the scientists claim the evidence is overwhelming. So I'll give you three things to think about. One, you and I could get involved in a conversation on this show about global warming, and we are amateurs. You do have to rely on experts, right? Bush says he wants to rely on the military experts in Iraq. Why is it that we don't trust our experts on global warming? And the evidence is overwhelming. You've got 99 scientists on one side for every scientist on the other side that says they don't believe the evidence. Secondly, when it comes to global warming, we should be applying the same test we applied when we went into Iraq. Think about what the conservatives and the Republicans and the Bush administration said about going into Iraq. They said, Saddam may have a nuclear bomb. He may give it to terrorists, they may sneak it into the U.S. and they may blow up an American city. Therefore, we cannot afford to let him continue in power. And some of us raised our hands and said, gee, you know, that seems really unlikely to us. And they said, do you want to take a chance? Condi Rice said it first. Vice President Cheney said it second. And President Bush said it third. And they basically said, we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud over an American city. Raising the specter of a nuclear explosion in an American city as an excuse to go into Iraq. So what they're doing, let's back up and look at the structure of this argument. They're saying that the potential outcomes are so catastrophic that even if there's just a tiny chance that we're right, you can't afford to let this go. You have to act. If there's even the slimmest chance that we're right, the results are too catastrophic to allow that possibility, so we must act. Well, now let's put that same logic to work on global warming. One nuclear weapon of some indeterminate size that wouldn't be as big as many of ours going off in or near an American city would be catastrophic, but we'd be talking about killing 100,000 people, maybe more. And I don't mean to make light of it, but the predictions from global warming are a realignment of the ecosystems around the world and catastrophic results for millions of people. Millions of people being relocated or possibly starved. I mean, in sub-Saharan Africa, as things get drier, there may be famines. The predictions are for huge upheaval and much more life than would be lost in a nuclear explosion. So the question I have for you, if you are a conservative Republican or someone who says, oh, global warming, we can't worry too much about that. It's probably not something we need to worry about. But you supported going into Iraq. Why is it that the same rules don't apply when it comes to the general structure of the argument? If it's that catastrophic, then you have to think twice about going in the case of Iraq. That was the argument. So if the results are that catastrophic and the predictions, and again, keep in mind, we got 99% of the scientists saying it's so. This is not Cheney talking about yellow cake and, an informant who goes by the name of Curveball for the CIA that internal reports, you know, strongly doubt his reliability. This isn't the flimsy evidence, the aluminum tubes, and all this other crap that the Bush administration relied on in secret as well. All this evidence is out on the table. By that I mean it's in the scientific journals. And yet we see people arguing past each other on television who they're not capable of reading the evidence, right? Only scientists are capable of reading the evidence. And the scientists who are, and there are thousands of them, have read the evidence and have come to a consensus. And again, it's a 99 on one side and one dissenter, and that's actually being generous to the dissenters. It's probably actually closer to 99.5% of scientists agree that global warming's real and that some percentage of it is man-made and that we could have an effect on it if we took action. The third issue I'll raise to wrap up global warming is essentially this, that the Bush administration, George Bush, when he was running for president, of course, he soft-pedaled it a little, but as soon as he got in, he made his arguments against global warming. But he argued that the cost would be too heavy. And he said, we can't afford it. It'll ruin the economy. But he never used a price tag. Let's imagine it was $100 billion a year. Let's imagine it was $200 billion a year. Let's imagine it was a total of $500 billion over 10 years. I don't know what the right number is. All right? But when the savings and loan debacle happened in the mid-'80s, during the deregulatory fever of the Reagan years, that cost the taxpayers $500 billion, half a trillion. Did we bat an eye? I guess we batted an eye, but the point is we paid it. We found $500 billion because we got surprised by that bill. And then Bush gets us into Iraq, and it's already cost us close to $500 billion. I don't know how you want to add up the numbers. If you add all the ancillary things, it's probably more than that already, and it'll certainly be more than $1 trillion by the time we're done. $1 trillion. But we're paying that because we have to. And so this argument that $200 billion a year is too expensive, when the catastrophic results, if the scientists are right, are so awesome, that doesn't hold water. And yet Bush got away with that argument. We never made him quantify the number. And they still don't. The opponents just say it would ruin the economy or it's too expensive. They never put a number on it. Besides which, we know now that there's a lot of technologies. You know, when new opportunities come up, when there's a problem, like we have to rebuild the infrastructure in this country, we got bridges collapsing, we got roads we're going to have to repave and repair at a higher rate than we've been doing. But that isn't not, it's a drain on the economy in that the taxpayers have to pay, you know, tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars for infrastructure, but it will help spur economic growth because it'll put people to work. It's the same with green technologies around helping global warming or helping deal with the energy issues. And I guess that's where I want to end up here tonight. Let me spend the last few minutes talking about the energy independence issue. One of the interesting things that's going on in this election cycle, if you are paying attention at all to what the Republicans are saying in their debates and what the Democrats are saying, there are two issues that come up around energy. One is global warming, and the other is energy independence or dependence on foreign oil. And the Republicans hate talking about global warming. I think most of them think it's a hoax, or it's not to be taken too seriously. Giuliani, I think, believes it should be taken seriously, but he hasn't said what he'd do about it. Like, he hasn't signed up for mandatory caps on carbon emissions yet. I don't think any Republican has. I think virtually every Democrat has signed up for that. So what happens is the Republicans tend to talk about energy independence, and the Democrats talk about both energy independence and global warming. So we've talked about global warming already. Let's deal with energy independence for a minute. There's a huge difference between the Republicans and the Democrats when it comes to energy independence, and in case you hadn't guessed, I have to come down on the side of the Democrats here, because the Republicans believe that we can produce our way to energy independence. And that is just demonstrably false. It's a foolish position to hold. But in an election year or cycle, plenty of candidates take foolish positions to convince the voters that the path ahead is painless. So what the Republicans are saying is, we'll drill in Anwar, we'll drill along the coasts of Florida, Texas, California, places we haven't drilled before. We'll do it safely, we'll have a small footprint, and we'll get energy independent. No. For example, suppose we drilled in Anwar, which, by the way, I'm up for a grand compromise where we get the left to agree to let us drill in Anwar for oil, and we get the right to agree to mandatory increases in energy efficiency, particularly in cars with the CAFE standards, as they're known. And the issue on the right, or for Republicans, is we will drill. But here's why it doesn't work alone. The estimate is that by, I want to say it's 2020, maybe 2030, I forget which year, the United States, I think it's 2020, the United States will import 65% of its oil. I forget, I think it's 49% or 55% we import now. No, I'm sorry, it'll be 68% we'll import in 2020. And if we drill in Anwar and tap that oil resources, I think it lasts 10 years, or maybe it's longer, we will only be importing 63%, 64% of our oil. In other words, it reduces it 4 or 5%. But we're still getting almost 2/3 of our oil from overseas. So it's a joke to claim that production alone gets us to energy independence. So until we have those magic fuels that we need, the fuel cells, the hydrogen fuel cells that Bush talks about, until we have nuclear fusion, cold fusion, whatever might come along the horizon that will get us off of petroleum-based products, until we put more nuclear plants online like France has, if that's the way we go, and that takes years and years and years to develop, we are stuck with using a heck of a lot of oil and paying a lot of money to the Middle East, to Venezuela, to Russia, to the countries that have the oil. Because when you think about it, most of the countries that have the oil, we don't like being held over their barrel. It's not like we're getting most of it from Canada, which we wouldn't like being held under their barrel either, I don't think. But it wouldn't be as bad. Anyway, the difficulty here is that there isn't a good answer on the production side. Now, if you want to start talking about economizing, there are many, many things we could do in the short term. By short term, I mean it takes a few years to put them in place. But the first thing you do is you tax gasoline. You know, it's been proposed before, a 50-cent a few years ago, a 50-cent a gallon tax on gasoline would reduce consumption immediately. Second thing you do is you increase the CAFE standards. I'd be up for a grand bargain between the CAFE standards and the drilling in Anwar. But the point is, you've got to be willing to have some pain here. You've got to be willing to cut back in some way if we're serious about reducing our dependence on foreign oil. It can't all be done with production, which is the Republican answer. You know, it was Dick Cheney who said when they got in office that conservation may be a personal, a good goal personally, you know, may be admirable, but it's no way to base an energy policy. He's exactly wrong. Of course it's a way to have an energy policy, but naturally the people we have in office, the president and the vice president, both came out of the oil industry. So what would their solution be? Use less oil? No. No more than somebody that produces Coca-Cola would say, you know, one of the things I think this country needs is to drink less Coca-Cola. That's not how it works. It is simply not. Anyway, we'll leave it there, and we'll have to save for next week the whole issue of where we go with General Sanchez. That's who I'm trying to think of. General Sanchez and the basic issue that we end up with in the general area of Iraq and whether or not this administration has got it all figured out or not. That'll do it for another edition of the Andy Finn Show. We will be back next week at 10 p.m., maybe 9:30 next week, and we'll be in our new studio, which will be great. Until then, you can read my stuff or listen to the shows at andyfinn.us. That's andyfinn.us. Until then, remember, do it. Don't doubt it.